Accession number 12878, Philip Lucas, Reel 2.
I have to go back to the Hurricane Spitfire. Now, the Hurricane Spitfire specification came out in 1934, and it called for a speed of no more than 275 miles an hour. And the penny dropped that Germany was rearming, and politically the go-ahead was given for the RAF to start expanding. So the pressure was on to get these airplanes out. Now, we knew that supermarines had far more experience than we did in designing high-speed airplanes through their Schneider Trophy experience. We had developed a line of airplanes in the form of the Hart series biplanes and Fury, Hawker Fury single-seaters, which were very practical airplanes for that period of time when nobody thought about the war. They were tubular construction with wooden combings, fabric covered, rugged, wide undercarriages, requiring very little maintenance, very easy to repair. And I'm not exaggerating, I would say that 80% of the Air Force was armed with Hawker airplanes, Harts, Hinds, and all the variants. And when the specification came out for this interceptor fighter calling for 275 miles an hour, we knew that provided we could handsomely beat the specification requirement, which is only 275, we had a good chance of winning the competition. And for that reason, we got our aeroplane flying first. And by the time we got the prototype up to Marsham, which was the then Boscombe, of course, they were so delighted, the pressure, the political pressure was on them to get these aeroplanes going, was such that they gave an immediate order. And then about 6 months afterwards, when the Supermarine went up, and they found it was about 50 miles an hour faster than Hurricane. Then there was the most tremendous pressure, of course. What do we order the Hurricane for? Here's an airplane, marvelous airplane, 50 miles an hour faster. Let's change it. Let's scrap the Hurricane and go for Spitfire. Thank God they didn't. I was very much involved at the time, and of course we fought like hell, and thank God common sense prevailed, because the numbers were such that it would have been impossible for us to have even just picked up the drawing and got into production, because supermarines were having great difficulty in producing the Spitfire in the numbers that were required within the necessary timescale. And the answer to that is, of course, the Hurricane was fast enough for the Battle of Britain. And we lost between about 400 Hurricanes. The Hurricane was the only modern fighter available to go to France when war broke out. About 400 Hurricanes were lost in France, mostly on the ground, before we pulled out of France. And yet, when the Battle of Britain started, a matter of 4 months later, 80% and the Royal Air Force was equipped with Hurricane aircraft. So, had they scrapped the Hurricane and only gone for the Spitfire, you see, we wouldn't have won the Battle of Britain. But anyhow, we merely perpetuated roughly the method of design in the Typhoon. We still had a very thick wing. And this is why we ran into compressibility troubles. Well, now, the way we combated that was quickly going around the squadron that involved myself and the other pilots, you know, educating the chaps, you know, to be very careful if they got into compressibility, not to trim themselves out of a dive, which was quite a natural thing, otherwise they'd come out and damn it, possibly lose their wings. But just at that time, the Battle of Britain was over, so the whole emphasis in the war switched from defence to attack. And in the instead of the operational heights going up and up and up and up, which they were, they came down and down and down and down. And of course, the Typhoon, because, and indeed the Hurricane, because of its thickness chord ratio, was a most wonderful ground attack aeroplane, mm-hmm. because it had a very low stalling speed mm-hmm. at maximum load. Mm-hmm. It could nip in and out of 1,500 yards is more or less the standard length of strip which the planners have arranged for the bulldozers, the Somerville tracking and all that goes with it, you see. And we had pilots, you know, with only about, I don't know, 9 months, years training, going fully operational on bombing low-attack missions on Typhoons, taking off in 1,500 yards, full load, and landing full load, which you couldn't have done on a Spitfire.
Mm. Mm.
So, you see, it was very fortunate at the time, but it did introduce compressibility troubles, and this is why we never discovered it during our early prototype, because, as you know, the speed of sound falls as the density there increases. Mm. I can't give you the exact case, but I was hoping there was Charlie Darwin to be in
the As it decreases, you mean, the higher you go, it falls, doesn't it?
The higher you go,
the higher you go, the lower it comes.
That's right, yes. Mm. And that is why we didn't, because yeah. we only thought of indicated speeds mm. then. Mm. To get the indicated speeds, we had to finish our dives, you know, within 1,000 feet of the ground.
Mm. Mm.
But had we started them very high altitude, we'd have run into it.
Mm. Mm.
Now, it wasn't discovered until quite a long time after the squad was going to service.
Mm.
And that was that. Mm. Now, when the Typhoon was superseded by the Tempest,
mm-hmm.
and the Tempest had a much thinner wing. And although you could get into, get into compressibility, it was very difficult, and nobody ever did in squad service. That I know.
You had to do it at quite high altitude.
Hmm?
You had to do it at quite high altitude.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. The temperatures are magnificent.
But was it used very much in a high altitude interceptor role? I mean, it was mainly used chasing doodlebugs, wasn't it? The Tempest, yes.
The Tempest was designed as a high altitude fighter.
Mm.
And the main reason why the Tempest made its name, and indeed the Typhoon,
mm.
was because, as I told you before, the operational requirements were operational heights of around 8,000 feet, mm. as opposed to about 30,000 feet. And by that time, there were thousands of Spitfires available, all sorts of mark numbers,
mm.
from, you know, the Spit 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you mm. name the number, and they went up to Spit 24, I think it was.
Mm. Mm.
And they did all the top cover fighting.
Mm. Mm. So you didn't really design the problem out of the Tempest, you just learned to
live with it? No, we didn't design it out.
No.
There was nothing you could do.
Mm.
You would have, we did design the problem out with the Tempest, by putting in thinner wings.
Mm. Mm. But then when you ran into the problem with the Tempest...
Yes, but I don't remember. I don't think anybody really ran into it. I think on tests you could produce it, but I don't think anybody in the squadron ran into it. Not within memory, to my knowledge. It wasn't a problem like it was in the Typhoon.
No. Because it was all coming in there. I mean, Hal Penrose told me the other day that with the Welkin.
Oh, well...
He had a lot of tucking under.
This is the narrowest squeak I ever had in my life. Really? You know, there were only three Welkins built.
Yeah.
And all three crashed, and I crashed one for them.
Really?
Yes.
Was that anything to do with compressibility?
Nothing. But it had it. Very much lower speed than the Typhoon. It is impossible. It was designed as a high-altitude fighter. And it was utterly useless. But we were having great trouble at the time with heavy ailerons. And I remember does it boil?
No, not okay.
And I remember I flew down to Boscombe Down and had lunch with a chap named N.E. Rowe, who at that time was the chief technical officer at Boscombe Down. And he said, "You know, Philip, we've got an airplane here called the Welkin, which we knew about." And he said, "They have got a most ingenious aileron control called a spring tab." And he said, "I think you ought to fly it because it might be able to help you with your problems." I said, "Yeah, sure. Right, well, when can I fly?" "Oh," he said, "well, I might be able to fly this afternoon." And sure enough, the airplane was available. So off I went. And damn me, I hadn't been in the air for about a quarter of an hour. I was climbing up when my port engine stopped. In fact, it caught fire. Started vibrating violently and belching out smoke. And so I'd never been in the airplane. I mean, I had no time to handle it or anything like that. I was merely climbing up to do a bit of handling. And so I called up Boscombe and told them I got an engine out and I was coming back. Well, as luck would have it, they were then building the concrete runway. And it meant landing crosswind on the grass on the short distance aerodrome. And I said, "Right, can you divert me to somewhere else where there's a long runway?" And they diverted me to Chilburton, which hadn't been opened. They'd just got the runway there. But then, having got that sorted out, I said, "Well, I better spend a bit of time trying to get used to the airplane, finding out what the story people are." And I put the undercarriage down and didn't go down. And so I used the emergency, which was window by gravity and locked. Then I found I had no instruments. And then I tried to put the flaps down. The flaps didn't come down. And I found all the hydraulics had gone. So I was very badly placed. And having to land this thing without brakes, no brakes, no flaps, on an airplane I'd never flown before.
No instruments.
And so I made a wide pass at Chilburton, looking over my left wing, found the whole port wing on fire. Now I didn't wait, I just stuffed it on the ground and went charging through Hitchin and that. And unfortunately it didn't turn over. By the time I got out, the port wing and the engine fell off. That was the third. So there weren't any more. And the other... Oh, no, that was the second, I'm sorry. The first one, the same thing. They all happened the same thing. The first one happened in the middle of a cloud, and the pilot got out. And the second one was me. And the third one was so frightened, having heard of what happened the first two, he didn't wait for anything. He simply shoved it down. He shoved it down and saw it be plain, knocked himself out. But there was an army pilot and an Austrian flying along, saw him go down, landed alongside him, yanked him up, put him in the airplane, flew him back to Boston, died, and he was in hospital within about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
That was the story of the three Wilkins.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that wasn't my job, anyhow.
Yeah. Can I just briefly ask you, your flying experience covered a tremendous range of development. I mean, you were flying, what, in the late 20s, early 30s?
Yes. I was a model for me in 1928, when I first started test flying.
Yes. And did you ever get to fly any jets at the end of the war?
Well, I did. I simply flew them, you know, to get the type in my logbook, and I wanted to see what they were like.
Mm.
But I'd given up flying.
Mm.
Mm. I hadn't given it up. But I mean, I didn't. I only used liaison airplane. I didn't do any professional flying after the war. I'd had a pretty good base before.
Is there any sort of general impression you had of the tremendous change over that period, from the little biplanes right through to the jet? A sort of personal impression. Not necessarily to do with flying, but with the state of technology, or could you summarise the great changes you experienced in that long career? Was there anything characteristic about the changes? I know it's a very, very abstract question.
Well, of course, you've got to remember that there was a war. And the pressure on getting new projects out was enormous. And equally so, there was tremendous pressure to avoid change. Because to get an airplane under wartime conditions, you couldn't do it now, of course, but under wartime conditions, to design it, flight develop it, get flight approval, get it into the squadrons, to get the squadrons operational. It was over a certain length of period of time. And therefore, you couldn't change much. All you could do was to get the airplane, which in your opinion was operationally acceptable, and let it go at that. And although there may have been many, many things one would like to have done, time just wouldn't allow it, because you were generally developing either an aeroplane or weapon system for a particular operation.
Mm-hmm.
And that time couldn't be changed.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to do the best you could. There were three big changes during the war, of course. We started off with the biplanes, and the Gladiator was the last of that generation of airplanes, the fastest and the best, shall we say, of the biplane fighters. We then came the Hurricane Spitfire era, which after all survived the whole war. And they, with Typhoon Tempest, which were really developments of the Hurricane, they were different airplanes, but they were very virtually the same sort of aeroplane, followed by the jet. And I should say that the most dramatic change, of course, was the introduction of the jet. And of course, with the general state of the knowledge, development since then. I mean, compare the Vampire and the Meteor with the Tornado and the F-4. I mean, as big a gap as that. Enormous.
What was the favourite aeroplane, the nicest one you flew, of all the different types?
I think it's almost impossible to say.
Mm.
Almost impossible to say, because you get very fond of an aeroplane, you know. Very fond of an aeroplane. An operational pilot is tremendously loyal. I mean, with the bombers, for instance, a good example was the what was the short, that awful
the Stirling.
The Stirling.
Mm.
you go and ask a Stirling crew whether would they rather fly Stirling on a Lancaster. They say Stirling every time. Marvellous aeroplane. Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful thing. You go to a Hurricane squadron, think, marvellous. Oh, yes, Hurricane's the best aeroplane in the world. You go to Spitfire pilot, you go, whoa, Hurricane like this. Well, that's class. Hurricane, much better aeroplane. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very difficult to say which is the best aeroplane. Mm-hmm. I can think of aeroplanes which I enjoyed flying first. I enjoyed flying the Hawker Fury. It was a lovely little airplane.
Lovely looker.
Yes. Mm. I enjoyed it, but it would never have been acceptable from a controllability to the standards which are set now. I enjoyed flying the Hurricane. It was a lovely airplane to fly because it was such a safe airplane. Did what you do, you could put it down anywhere. I enjoyed flying the Typhoon by the time we finished developing it and had this marvellous bubble hood on it. I mean, the Typhoon, we started off with the worst view of any aeroplane which had ever been designed and finished off with the best view of any aeroplane which had ever been designed, with the bubble hood, which is now on every aeroplane, even now. So it's a difficult question to answer.
You were mentioning just now the fuselage structural problem you had on the Tornado, and you said you would come
back.
We
had
no
structural problems on the Tornado. We only had one or two.
No.
We had no structural problems on the Typhoon. You, I presume, are referring to an incident which I had.
Mm.
That was nothing to do with structural strength. It was pure directional stability, purely directional stability. We were always Hawkers not to be quoted, or Sydney Camp, and don't quote me.
No,
it is on.
I'll turn it off for a second. Yes. Now your remark about the small fins. I mean, I've gone into this in a lot of detail because Rowley Beaumont first brought this up on inertial coupling.
Yes.
The problem they had in America with the F-100.
Yes.
Which I've gone into detail with Dick Johnson, who told me a lot about it.
And you very often, you see, if you've got directional instability, you very often change the trim as well.
Mm.
You get to change the trim as well.
Mm. And that led to this.
Yes. Oh, I'm very sorry. Yeah, of course, we had a lot of structural trouble on the Typhoon. Mm. We had 28 tails off.
Mm.
I'm crazy. Of course, we had it, This was a matter of very great concern because, I lost one of my pilots, a fellow named Kenneth S. Smith.
Mm-hmm.
The whole box tail section broke off like a carrot at the transport joint where the tail joined on the fuselage. And we had 28 off. And it wasn't until about the 27th where we had a pilot who survived and was able to... his tail didn't come off. We didn't know why it came off. We knew... We mounted a research program which in those days was almost equal to what was done on the Comet when they disappeared. We had a tremendous test program set up of trying different diving attitudes, divergent tests on while we were diving, you know, by pulling the aircraft out of different G's, moving the rudder backwards and forwards so we could get all the various conditions, and we were never able to produce it at Langley, and yet the tails kept on coming off. We knew, for instance, there were cases where there were flights of three aircraft flying at comparatively low speeds, and I'm talking comparatively low, probably around about 350 miles an hour, or even less, when the tail would suddenly come off and the thing would bunt and the pilot was killed. And it happened over and over again, and we spent our time charging around the countryside, picking up the bits. I kind of said, I forgot this. And it wasn't until about the week before D-Day, oh, incidentally, I should say, needless to say, all our engineers, we had technical representatives on each aerodrome looking after the machines. Everybody did, of course. And they had very definite instructions that any incident was to be immediately reported to me, personally. And the week before D-Day, all the Typhoon wings were down in the Bournemouth area. And they were spent the whole time bombing, rocketing, machine gunning radar sites along the Normandy coast. And about 11 o'clock one night, the telephone went, and it was one of our chaps at Hearn Airport, and said, look, he said, I think we've got a coup. I can't go into details, but I'm in a pub, and there's a sergeant pilot here who obviously had something funny happen, but we can't find anything wrong with the airplane. I said, right, I'll be down the next day. And I flew down the next day and looked at the airplane, couldn't find anything wrong. Flew it, couldn't find anything wrong. But talked to the pilot, and he said, well, he said, you see, most of these pilots were terribly inexperienced. Mm-hmm. They weren't engineers, even. Mm-hmm. You know, they were any profession you like to think of, you name it. Mm-hmm. They came from all broad sections of industry and society. And so they couldn't describe what happened. But something funny, he said, I was diving in the ground, and he said, as soon as I'd finished firing my rockets off, I was firing my guns, and I pulling out of the dive, and all of a sudden the stick was flying about all over the cockpit, you see. And by that time I pulled out of my dive, and everything was all right. And he treated it as a joke. And I mean, I think if he hadn't been a bit alcoholic, he probably wouldn't have told it to our rep. So this was immediately reported to the people who were investigating the accidents, and the aircraft was dismantled and taken to Farnborough, and the Farnborough people vibrated the airplane, and they found the natural frequency of the aircraft, and that there was a node exactly opposite where the mass balance of the elevators were inside the fuselage, and they obviously it was tailplane flutter. Now all the flutter experts had been into it, and they said, oh no, it's not flutter. It can't be flutter. And we kept on strengthening up. We strengthened the tailplane spar. We strengthened up the straps joining the transport section. All sorts of mods we added with our tongues in our cheeks. But we had to be shown to do something. But every time we did a mod, a strengthening mod, it happened again. Mm. And it was traced to flutter. We had elevator mass balance was a remote mass balance operated by a series of linkages installed in the fuselage. Uh-huh. And it had, I can't remember the exact weight, but I think I'm right in saying that it had a 6-pound weight on the end of an arm through linkages to the elevator. They changed that weight from 6 pounds to 8 pounds. We never had another tailplane. Now that took probably a couple of years to find out. Yeah. Because everybody was killed.
Yeah.
And it was very unnerving, I might tell you, for our test pilots having to try to reproduce it. And we had one chap killed.
Incredible. And that, so the situation would arise where the natural frequency of the fuselage.
Yes, a set of combinations. You couldn't tell a combination of speed, radar speed, temperature, hitting a bump like that, and start triggering it off. And the thing that came off like that.
It's the same thing as soldiers marching in step over a bridge, I suppose.
That's
you suddenly get it and
absolutely.
Then snap.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. How fascinating. But this, of course, was nothing to do with your accident.
Nothing to do with the drop. No, no. Apparently in the direction of Mr. Boot. I increased the fin area.
Yes.
And the run area and the road drop.
Yes. Fine. Well, thank you very much. I think I've got
what I came for. Well, thank you very much.